Well, 10 foot is the longest length you're going to get. That's the code requirement for making that. But up to what size? You want 4 inch, 6 inch? You can get it up to that length, that width. But the standards are, you know, it goes half, three quarter, 1 inch, inch and a quarter, inch and a half, two, two and a half, three, three and a half, four, and on up, all the way to 6 inch.
6126.
KB2YEW with a comment. YEW, we'll get to you in a second. Yeah, is that 6061 T6, or not, probably not T6, because you guys want to bend it. Probably not heat treated, but is it a 6061 alloy, if you happen to know, Carl?
Nah, that I don't know.
KB2YEW, go ahead with your question or comments, or start off with your name.
Yeah, name here is Guy, and just in case people aren't in the trade, the diameters that you're going to be speaking of, what electrical conduit is going to be inside diameter. So just for argument's sake, you know, you got three quarters, you're talking inch and an eighth OD. So just check on, if it's that specific, check on your OD, because they measure by inside diameter.
Yeah, run that by again, Guy. If the three-quarter inch ID is inch and an eighth OD, that means a quarter plus an eighth. That means I've got three-eighths of an inch of difference. I think you're telling me three-sixteenths of an inch of wall thickness, so that there's three-eighths of an inch of difference between ID and OD. Pretty stiff, heavy stuff. Have I got that correct, Guy? Go ahead.
Yeah, you do. Half-inch conduit is 7/8 OD, three-quarters, inch and an eighth, and it just keeps going up. But it's pretty thick, and it does pit, okay? It does pit when you're using it for outside. So what I do, because I also use aluminum conduit, I prime it and paint it, and you just might want to take a little emery to it just to get the kind of the sheen off of it that they use, and prime it and paint it, then it'll last forever.
Very fine. What's your favorite priming material on aluminum that takes very well to it? I can see why you would use emery paper on the aluminum, or maybe steel wool. No, I don't recommend steel wool, because that's going to give you a steel-aluminum compound where you rub it. So you could rub it with Scotch-Brite. I think that would be safe, or with emery paper, like you say. And then what's your favorite kind of paint or primer that you would use, a guy, that you think really adheres to the aluminum well and survives the ultraviolet and temperature cycling and everything else of outdoors? You got it, Guy.
Go to a paint store. Anything that's graded for marine grade, you're looking at superior quality.
Krylon, Dick, makes a very good product.
Yeah, they do.
And the Krylon paint specifically says intended for application to aluminum?
Now they have a product that's excellent. I sprayed a bean. I had the bean down last June, Dick, and I cleaned up all the elements because, you know, if I don't maintain it here every so many years by the ocean here, it becomes a real mess. So I cleaned up all the elements, like you say, buffed them down, and then spray them up with Krylon, and it looks like a brand new antenna up there. And it lasts for many, many years.
Good suggestion. Now, Bob, if you're still with us, if I know you, you were probably refurbishing the living daylights out of that Cushcraft beam of yours. I'll bet you even disassembled the loading coils to make sure they were nice and clean inside. Is that true, Bob? W2OSR, K2RIW?
Okay, Dick, sorry about that. W2OSR here. Unfortunately, the way Cushcraft makes their traps, they're almost impossible to take apart to work on. The best I could do was using a vacuum cleaner and a compressor to blow as much junk out of there as I could. And in one or two cases, I actually ran water through the trap to flush it out, and then dried it out real good with the air compressor and the vacuum cleaner again, so there's no residual water. But it was fun. And you asked me the other day about the holes in the trap. which I said were roughly around a 16th of an inch in diameter. So what I'm doing now to keep the little insects and other stuff from growing in there is a piece of fiberglass with a window screen glued on over the hole with the holes in the window screen still there in that area.
Okay, now, your Cushcraft beam, how many elements have loading coils? This is question number one, Bob. How many of those loading coils have material inside? And if you could possibly, simply important information, describe the material that was in there. I think you and George of HUWKV were having a conversation, and George were calling the animals spider mites, the animals that went in there and built these nests. And if I understand correctly, they were hauling in pieces of straw and building their spider webs and making their nests and essentially filling up much of the volume inside of the housing for your loading coil. So just think, call up the mast, call up the chimney or tower, call up the mast, walk across the boom of the Yagi, walk down the element of the Yagi, crawl around to where the weep hole is on the loading coil, crawl in there and deposit the stuff, and do nests. Wow! Are those animals enthusiastic? So how many loading coils, how many of them have the stuff, and what does the stuff look like? Take your time. I'd love to know more about this. Back to you, Bob. KQRIW.
Okay, Dick. W2OSR. Well, there on each element of this, I mean, there are three elements. There are a total of four traps, two on each side. So three times four, we come up with, I believe it's one, had a fistful of what looked like dry grass inside of it. That's not to mention little insect nests and insect carcasses that were coming out of there as well.
Wow. Now, by the way, a total of two loading coils on each side, four per element, three elements, that's 12 loading coils. Still, that's a lot of loading coils. I have the impression that more than one of them had all this jazz inside. At least one of them, you get from time to time, the guys who run 1,500 watts peak envelope power into the Cushcraft Yagis occasionally get a failure of one of these loading coils. And I am guessing there are ham radio operators who think that the all of the extra foreign material in the loading coil housing could be an aggravating factor that accelerates or aggravates the failure of the loading coil when you're running high power. Of your 12 loading coils, was one of them really stuffed tight and another two of them mildly stuffed and some of them untouched, or was there stuff in almost all of them? And do you think the antenna was up in the air for 6 months or 6 years? I wonder how long it took for these animals to build all these nests. Back to you, Bob.
Okay, W2OSR. Well, based on what the gentleman told me that I bought it from, it was his backup antenna. And looking at the oxidation on the aluminum, I would say it's probably 3 or 4 years old. Still looks in rather good shape, polished up pretty quickly when I put the Scotch-Brite pad on the areas that I was cleaning up. And by the way, the other thing I'll tell you about is plumbers use wire brushes for copper tubing for cleaning the inside when they're doing the sweat joint. Well, I picked up two brushes that worked out very nicely for cleaning up the inside areas that I couldn't get at with the Scotch-Brite pad.
Fantastic. Now, in the case of the steel, and I think it's a stainless steel brush that people use in the plumbing business for cleaning up the end of pipes that they're about to solder together. Not only is it a stainless steel, which I think leaves no residue, but they're about to solder it immediately before any further corrosion, oxidation, dissimilar metal problems, or whatever can take place. However, for we amateurs who are refurbishing an antenna, to rub it down with Scotch-Brite and then paint it is a great way to go. I'd be reluctant to suggest steel wool for fear that you're making a steel-aluminum compound where you're rubbing it, and that may create extra corrosion on the surface downrange. Of your 12 loading coils, how many of them had this foreign material in there Were only a few of them really stuffed, or is one or two more of them lightly loaded? How many of them had bug material in there, Bob? Go ahead.
About two or three of them had enough that you would really have to worry about it. The others had little bits and pieces in there. Of course, some of them I didn't look at until after I used the shop vac on them. And there what I did was I had a tapered nozzle on my shop vac on the 2-inch hose that came with it, and I cut it so it was just slightly larger diameter than the outside of the trap, and literally slid the trap down into the hose with my thumb over the center hole so the vacuum would suck as much out of the trap as it could.
Very nice. So, and the one that was really stuffed, was it packed really tight? I think you said straw, nests, the animals themselves. Were there dead animals in there? And from what you could tell, was the space 90% filled with all of their fouling material? How tightly was the empty space in there? And is the housing for the trap, is it roughly half air inside and half a loading coil, so to speak? And was almost all of that space filled up? Try to give me a little bit of a description there on the worst one, if you can, Bob. Go ahead.
Well, the worst one would have been filled up about 60 to 75% with stuff, and it was, well, you know, figuring in that volume, it was somewhat densely packed. As I'm saying, if you looked at it, I rinsed the thing out after I took the cover off. That was the one I did take the cover off. And after doing that one, I decided not to do that anymore because it looked too risky in terms of having aluminum break from fatigue of being bent, is what I had to do to get the cover off.
Wow. Those animals are enthusiastic. And previously, did he have that mounted on a mast that was on the chimney, or do you think he had that on a small tower or a telescoping mast? Where was the antenna located before you bought it, do you think, Bob?
I tell you truthfully, Dick, I have no idea where he had it mounted. The gentleman was up in Maine, and I know there's lots of insects in Maine, especially come around June, so I'm not sure exactly what was in there. As I said, I did see some small spiders, and as I said, most of it looked like dead vegetation.
Did the spiders look like they had died in location? Or do you think they were still alive at the time you bought the beam?
Most of them were dead, but I did see about four or five little tiny ones.
Four or five tiny ones, meaning possibly alive?
Yes, they were wiggling and running around.
Wow. My goodness, those animals are enthusiastic. In fact, it almost doesn't matter whether it was mounted on the chimney of his house, on a telescoping mast, or on a tower. In either case, if these were non-flying insects and little insects and little spiders fall into that category, just think of the enthusiasm of the path they have to travel from Mother Earth, where they're collecting the materials, all the way up the side of the house, up the chimney, across the mast, across the boom, down the element. Remember, you know, the trip they're taking, and crawl into that little hole in order to build their nest, and do that thousands of times to collect all the material. Wow. Those guys really are after us, Bob. these guys have zeroed in on ham radio operators, and they're going to get us. Wow. Someday you guys are going to hear about more why I'm enthusiastic about this, because I'm excited by this situation. Okay. Before we keep everybody to sleep, getting buggy here, we probably ought to go over to at least... is there anybody who has signed in that we haven't covered yet before we go over to Paul for the space section tonight? Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW with Mel.
Yeah, this is K2KEY.
Okay, Mel, I know you've got at least one email, and there's probably other people on the list that I don't know about. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, you know, I was just going to make a quick comment. I used to watch, we used to have on the camera enclosures. Sometimes they would be building something, and right in front of the lens, you could see the whole operation going on, sometimes even into the enclosures. How they used to tear open, some of the birds used to be able to tear open the screen, the ventilating screen in the rear, and build a nest in there right in front of the lens and some of the big old enclosures. where there was plenty of room to get in there. And like I say, you watch the whole show right on the front of the lens on your monitor. There was one question that I think maybe I answered right, maybe I answered wrong, or maybe you can give more insight. WA2RYY Joe had a question about a piece of his equipment, and he thought maybe you would have a little bit more of an insight into it, Dick. And then, yes, Paul had checked in. Go over to Paul. And then, yes, I do have one email that, well, a couple of them that, something that we discussed a few weeks ago, to go over it again, Dick. K2RIW, this is K2KEY with a Limark TechNet. Go ahead, sir.
To go. And that would have been last week, and I was sick and away last week. So, Joe, if you're there, WA2RYY, go right ahead with any further question or comment you've got. K2RIW.
Okay, good evening, Dick. WA2RYY here. I'll repeat the whole question so you'll have it in its entirety for picking it apart. This is actually a friend of mine's equipment. It's not my equipment. It's a 220 repeater system. And I'm just talking about the receiver part of the network right now. The receiver itself is about, say, 0.2 or so for 20 dBm of quieting. Say minus 122, somewhere around there, you'll come up with a figure if you measure it. When you put a preamp in front of it, a working, known working preamp, 20 dB gain, 0.5 dB noise figure, all that kind of happy stuff, two known good working preamps, they will make the receiver get worse in sensitivity by about a factor of about 6 dB or so. The receiver used to work a long time ago, it used to work correctly. It actually would help it the other way, went about 6 or 7 dB positive gain. Now it has about 6 dB negative gain.
Okay, and I do remember asking you last time, 2 weeks ago, transmitter was not turned on when you're doing the measurement. You're fairly sure that your particular source of signal, something like a Cushman or a IFR, really can put out 0.2 of a microvolt without giving you leakage of the package. In other words, if I took a Hewlett-Packard typical laboratory signal generator and tried to turn it down to 0.2 of a microvolt, the leakage from the cabinet would be considerably stronger. Therefore, you would know something funny is going on because you move your body around the room, you move your hands around the signal generator, and you would see the 20 dB quieting going up and down. You know that something funny is going on. There's a sneak path. So I'm first going to assume transmitter is turned off. You know you've got a good source of signal generator that's well shielded, and there is no sneak path effects through its B-plus wiring to the preamp or whatever. Let me send it back to you for a confirmation on those before we go forward. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, Dick. Measurements were done with the transmitter, repeater transmitter off, and not through the duplex. It was done directly on the back of the receiver. Let me describe the instrumentation I'm using. I'm using an IFR 1500 service monitor for a signal source. The output attenuator has been verified to be correct because I have the instrumentation to do so. Are you familiar with an HP 8594 analyzer? You ever heard of those?
I believe that's a spectrum analyzer, and when you use it to measure signals, very small signals, that's an extremely accurate instrument when used well. It's also got a well-shielded cabinet, so it'll be measuring what's coming down the cable from the attenuator of the 1500 IFR, and that'll give you a good reading. If you had a sneak path through air, through the cabinet of the IFR, which I doubt, I think IFR has already been down this road and they've solved that problem, but if there was a sneak path, you might not see the sneak path on the 8594, whereas the receiver with the preamp might, because I do know for a fact that the AR squared preamps are by repeater standards not properly shielded. That's an opinion. My opinion is that AR squared makes a beautiful product, but the amount of shielding of the box that the gas-fed preamps are built in is not shielded well enough for repeater service, in my opinion. Back to you, Joe.
Okay. I have the matching amplifier. I guess you'd call it a preamp. that goes with the 8594E. It's a very expensive preamp. I don't recall the gain figure, or the exact gain figure. I believe it's 25 dB, and I think I measured it to be a little less than that, but and I don't know specifically what the noise figure is. But what the analyzer said in a narrow band type of operation, narrow bandwidth and narrow dispersion, I can realistically look at a signal level of about minus 140 and realistically tell you if it's there or not. And how I know this is because I've tested the IFR service monitor with precision pads that will actually pad, you know, pad the signal besides the attenuator itself to actually make the the level get down to where I want to measure. So I'm proving my, I'm proving my instrumentation both ways. I am actually generating a signal down that low. I don't have leakage out of the generator, and the signal does not change when they move around. And all my test cables I'm using are either RG142, or in a case when I measured it with this, I used, I believe, quarter-inch Superflex. So I was pretty careful to take a step-by-step piece of everything to make sure I wasn't...
Fantastic. All right, you've done your homework on calibrating the signal, confirming it with another independent method as to signal strength, your 8594 with its preamp, particularly when you use the low resolution bandwidth on it and the small amount of span. Yes, I have no doubt that you can measure a minus 140 dBm signal. And you're trying to measure, let's see, 2/10 of a microvolt. Let's see now, if it was a 1/10 of a microvolt, it would be 20 dB below 107. That would be 127. 6 dB above that, 121. You're trying to measure minus 121 dBm. That's approximately what 2/10 of a microvolt is. And so you're 20 dB into your instrumentation of giving you a strong signal, so no problem there. My next suggestion, Joe, is that if you've got any kind of a directional coupler, even if it's not rated for the right frequency range, even if it's rated much higher, much lower, whatever, if you've got any kind of a miniature directional coupler that you can put in between the preamp and the 220 receiver. With that directional coupler, it'd be nice if it was, say, a 10 dB directional coupler, 6, 10, 20, whatever, coupler of the preamp, 10 dB down if it's a 10 dB coupler, and the straight-through line is going straight into the receiver. And then you put the directional port of the directional coupler into the spectrum analyzer. And you do that while you're making the measurement, while you're putting in the 2/10 of a microvolt. And then while you're using that directional coupler, if you take that 8594 spectrum analyzer and start scanning wider and wider, you'll have to change the res bandwidth when you do it, but you're looking for any mysterious signal, a local oscillator leaking out of the receiver, an oscillation of the gas-fed preamplifier, any other mysterious signal. Because the quickest way I know of that a preamplifier that has a confirmed noise figure of, say, 0.5 dB, of noise figure, and approximately 20 dB of gain, because that's what most gas-fed AR squares have in this frequency range, 432 and down, they've all got 20 or 22 dB of gain. So you and I know that the signal-to-noise ratio has to improve when you add the preamp, on the assumption you're not running a barefoot receiver that's got a 1/10 of a dB noise figure, which is very unlikely. So the next thing I would suggest is you start looking as wider and wider as you can to see if there's any other mysterious signal there. If the preamp is getting a strong signal from some source, whether it's breaking into oscillation, whether it's found some other signal somewhere in the system, and if that strong signal can be seen on the directional coupler after the preamp into the spectrum analyzer, then of course you have to start sniffing to find out where that's coming from. Without there being any other strong signal present, which is shoving the preamp into limiting, without the preamp itself oscillating, obviously you know that you're describing something that is seemingly impossible. By everything you know, the preamp got to have a number of dB less noise figure than the barefoot receiver. And all of the past history of communication engineering tells us you add a loop in front of a receiver that has less than ideal noise figure, the overall noise figure of the system must improve. Therefore, the sensitivity must improve. And I guess the only other thing I can think of here is there is a slim chance that the receiver itself, seeing all the extra bandwidth of noise coming out of the preamp, and here's something else that's a long shot, but a possibility. Although the preamp is rated for 220 megacycles, it probably has significant gain across that whole frequency region. Therefore, the earlier stages of the receiver are seeing a tremendous bandwidth of noise. And there's a possibility that the earlier stages, a slim possibility that the total gain in front of the limiter stage is making it behave in a funny way. So the next thing I would suggest, after you've done the directional coupler, wide scan, spectrum analyzer look, the next thing I would try is putting in a 3 or a 6 or a 9 decibel attenuator in between the preamp and the receiver. Preamp output, attenuator, receiver input. And repeat the measurement for 20 dB quieting. If the 3, 6, or 9 dB attenuator should make the sensitivity degrade a little bit, a couple of tenths of a dB. If it suddenly improves by a lot of dB, and you've got a 6 dB error to look for, that's another very strong clue. I wonder if any of these things make any sense, Joe. By the way, your signal sounds a lot better tonight. Have A2RYY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
WQB to you, you think. The other station, go ahead.
Good afternoon, evening, gentlemen. The panel here is Larry. I'll make you here, Peter Upcam. I'm located in Robinson County. I was reading the mail, and it seems like you fellas know what you're talking about. And I have a quick, easy question. It might seem kind of trivial to compare what you guys are talking about. I have a situation where I'll leave a search and rescue on a snowmobile, and I'm using the Yaesu handheld, and the headset I'm using, the microphone is so hot that as soon as I put it on, with the machine running in the wind, the audio, the microphone's picking up so much noise from the machine and the wind that it makes transmission almost impossible. Any ideas how to cut down on the sensitivity of the microphone? I've tried padding it, but that doesn't work.
Okay, Larry, we're in the middle of the so-called technical net, and we're discussing Joe's question right now, and we're going to put you on the list of the next person that we're going to get to. And I'm not sure we've got a simple solution for yours, but you're getting us off subject. We went over to you thinking that you had a hint on the subject matter that's on the table right now at this particular session of the TechNet. So back to you, Joe, where I made the suggestion of the directional coupler, the wide scan with the spectrum analyzer, and the padding experiment. You might have some comments that maybe you've already done some of those. W2RYY, K2RIW in the technical net.
Right, right. I do have a nice strong signal repeater. I am totally duplex, and I'm not going to get stepped on this time. But anyway, I've tested the preamp. The preamp does indicate 20 dB gain on the analyzer. I run the input level up into the preamp to the point where I can see the preamp start to compress or not amplify anymore, and it seems to match about what the manufacturer says. I believe they tell you it's something like plus 12... something like plus 12 for 1 dB of compression. So if I put it theoretically a signal in of like, minus 10, minus 6, something like that, you can actually start seeing the compression. So I'm running it way below compression. I have not checked the output of the preamp with the directional coupler to see if it's oscillating, but I have tried two different preamps of the same manufacturer. One was just came back from repair. It was never put on the repeater. I use it as a repeater. The repeater's never keyed up with it or whatever. And I did the test with that brand new preamp that was repaired and certified from a squared R, and I got exactly the same kind of results. I tried a 3 dB pad after the preamp, and that made virtually no difference as far as my measurements. It really didn't help or do anything at all. In fact, it made it slightly worse. So this is definitely a strange problem. But the thing of it is this: with the same preamp and same receiver, a long time ago, it had a positive gain. Something happened to it, and now it has a negative gain. I think something happened. My TOT went out my radio here. I think something happened inside this guy's 220 repeater, but I can't. I want to try to just get more input on it as far as what I should look for. I believe it has a single RF amplifier stage. It's got two helical resonators in front of that, maybe three, and a couple more before it hits the mixer. He had an effect a long time ago, running the whole thing duplex. He had amp, which is a pass-notch duplex, a self-notch, but he had no other pass cavity on there. And those things don't have a really great deal of RF selectivity as far as passage. There's maybe 20, 25 dB out of band. That's all they're going to give you. They're not that terribly narrow. And he had an effect happen one day where something, I think, happened, was intact for a split second, and he got a tremendous amount of noise that drove the S-meter up on the repeater like a pin did. And right after that seemed to happen, this effect started to be noticed, that the thing was deaf, and it just didn't work right anymore with preamp.
Yeah, that preamplifier stage that's in the barefoot repeater with the less than ideal helical resonators or whatever for the bandpass filter, that preamp itself in the repeater could have been cooked. The mixer stage could have been cooked. The local oscillator may be flaky. The more I'm thinking about this, I realize that if the preamplifier that's there had a partial failure, so-called latent failure from electrostatic discharge, let's assume that this condition he had where the noise figure went, where the noise power went through the ceiling for a short period of time. That could have been precipitation static, the beginning of a thunderstorm or whatever. Repeaters do see some very strange lightning-like conditions that can make tremendous signal strengths. And so you could have a partially damaged dual-gate gas-fed preamp in front of the mixer of the repeater receiver itself, a damaged mixer, or insufficient LO. If the local oscillator power was right at the threshold where the mixer was starved for LO power, when you increase the noise power into the mixer, you get some peculiar characteristics. You get signal cross noise terms, as they say. The mixer starts behaving in a nonlinear manner. The preamp that's in there now, if it's a dual-gate gas fed, I'm guessing, it could have suffered partial damage, such that its intercept point went into the ceiling, went into the cellar. And now the extra noise power going into it makes it will hurt signal-to-noise ratio. That's the good news, and one of the very well-kept secrets about limiters is that as long as the carrier-to-noise ratio, this is putting it in the terms of the Bi 1953, wrote a classic book called Lectures on Communication System Theory. The Baghdadi book is the Bible on the subject of limiters. Not easy to understand, written in deep mathematical engineering language, but you study that section on limiters enough and you see some beautiful things. An ideal limiter in the IF strip of a receiver, when the carrier to noise ratio in the bandwidth of the IF, when the carrier to noise ratio is positive, in other words, the total power of the signal in the IF strip versus the total power of the noise in the IF strip is a positive number, if the limiter is ideal, followed by a good bandpass filter, will give you 6 decibels of improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. Every good limiter will do that. It's one of the many reasons why you put a limiter in front of the discriminator of a good FM receiver. There's a catch. As the signal gets weaker and weaker and starts approaching the noise power that's in the IF strip, the limiter will hurt you. Once the carrier-to-noise ratio starts going negative, the limiter will be captured on noise and it will suppress the signal. NASA recognized that problem when it comes to the FM modulation for astronaut audio for the Gemini, Mercury, and Apollo program. As such, they've got a special circuit, recognizes the decreasing carrier-to-noise ratio, and starts backing off on the gain in front of the limiter to take it out of the limiting level. So in other words, they've got an analog circuit that backs off on limiting function when the signal gets weak so that they don't run into what's called the crashing problem. So a carrier that's weaker than the signal in an IF strip into a proper operating limiter will hurt you. The limiter will hurt instead of help. It only works well when the carrier is slightly stronger than total noise power. So if you've got a preamplifier in the receiver that's been damaged by electrostatic discharge or whatever, and now it's got a very low level of output intercept point, not the plus 10 or plus 12 dBm of your AR squared preamp, but it may be something extremely small so that the total noise power you're putting, and it's got an extremely broad RF bandwidth compared to an IF strip, and you're putting in an extremely weak signal. Now that extra noise power with the limiting of that stage, which is defective, will suppress exactly 6 dB, the magic number. You get 6 dB of suppression when the carrier is weaker than the noise of the limiting stage. And that preamplifier has got a lot of bandwidth. Wow. Hey, Joe, I think we've hit something here. Overly coincidental that you see exactly 6 dB of decrease. I think it's time that you really, by one means or another, by substitution or whatever, measure the health of that preamplifier that went through hell when he saw that extremely strong noise power on some particular day. You've now got to check the health of the preamplifier that's in the receiver, the mixer that's in the receiver, and the local power that's in that mixer. If any one of those three are defective, you could be going into limiting on noise power, and you will get 6 dB of suppression of your weak signal, because it's running on a very broad bandwidth. Therefore, the total noise power it's seeing is a hell of a lot stronger than what's going on in the IF strip downrange. I wonder if you need a repeat on any of this, Joe. I wonder if you see what I'm saying. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W on the TechNet.
No, I'm starting to follow you on this. It's like some Motorola equipment, for example, with the amount of limiters they use in there. Their receivers limit very, very early, and I understand what you're saying here, but if it limits too early, it's going to start getting affected by a low power power level signal coming in. It's starting to make some sense now, because it is about a 6 dB decrease in usability now, like the magic number, like you said. But I guess what I don't know is how exactly I can check that device under whatever means to determine if it really is dead or not. It's easy to take, just simply say, well, just change the transistor, just change the device. Yes, I can do that, but it's very time consuming to take the whole thing apart and do that.
I know a way to do it. You've got the instrumentation. That 8594, with or without the preamp, makes the world's best sniffer. Even if you took nothing more than a 10-to-1 oscilloscope probe, and the reason I chose a 10-to-1 oscilloscope probe, and maybe you're going to put a 10K resistor in series with it, or a 1 picofarad resistor in series with the probe, you're going to probe the output of that first stage of RF amplification. Don't have to replace the transistor, just find a point where you can tap into the signal. And you first tap into the signal going into the preamp of the receiver, and you run the signal up and down from your IFR. You carefully remember what amplitudes you saw going in. You do the exact same thing in the output of that stage. You're trying to make very light coupling, and who cares if the if you've got a 20 dB attenuator between your probe and the actual the 8594, the spectrum analyzer. As long as you can see the signal, you can then run the signal up and down into that preamp and find out, can the preamp that's there go to plus 10 dBm of power output without going into 1 dB of compression? And the same thing you can do with the mixer, and the mixer input and the mixer output, and maybe even the first IF stage, by sniffing with a scope probe. And you're going to make sure your scope probe does not load down the circuit and does not detune the circuit. You're either going to put it in a scope probe, or you're going to make yourself a sniffer probe. A voltage sniffer probe that does not detune the circuit. And by sniffing in and out of each of those stages, as you run your IFR up and down, you're going to find out what is the amplitude limiting level of each one of those stages. It would completely fit what you're measuring, and you can do that measurement. Back to you, Joe, W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. W2RYY here, back. That's an interesting theory. I'm going to definitely have to think about trying that. I think I have the instrumentation to be able to do that beside the analyzer as far as a probe. I wonder if an RF detector, I have an RF detector probe that basically gives you a DC type of output. I've used that on the IFR for sweep purposes, and that's good. I know if you're at least 700 meg. I don't know if that would be any help in this type of situation, or just simply need a regular scope probe.
I think your RF sniffer will not do the job, because you're making measurements of extremely small signal. Minus 121 dBm or whatever it is, 2/10 of a microvolt, is an extremely weak signal, and that's 40 dB away from the threshold of your RF probe. And your RF probe is, like you said, 500 megs wide. It's looking at tremendous amounts of noise. You only care what happens at 221 megacycles. You can tune the spectrum analyzer to 221 plus or minus a megacycle or whatever, and zero in on that frequency region and find out what's happening. That's what you care about. That the DC, that RF probe you've got is looking so wide It's seeing so much noise, it's not going to see the signal, doesn't have anywhere near the sensitivity. That spectrum analyzer of yours goes down to minus 140 dBm. I'll be amazed if that RF probe of yours goes down to minus 45 dBm. So you're only 80 dB shy with that approach, if you know what I mean. So no, I don't recommend that. I recommend you make yourself, you've got the technology, you know how to do it, you know how to make yourself at the end of a piece of RG58 cable. If you want to make yourself your own probe, you can do it with a 1 picofarad coupling capacitor, maybe a resistor divider network with 10K resistors. There's a zillion ways you can do it. But you're going to make the probe in such a way that when the probe is touching the circuit, it's an extremely minor perturbation to the circuit, not detuning it, not loading it down. And now, but still enough of the signal is getting into the spectrum analyzer. The spectrum analyzer has got so darn much sensitivity that you can throw away sensitivity and therefore make the probe a very light load on the circuit. But a spectrum analyzer, because of its resolution bandwidth and narrow scan width and whatever, can give you all the sensitivity in the world. Therefore, you can see the phenomena you're looking for. And right now, you've given me enough description that it makes it sound to me like you've got a damaged preamplifier stage, or a damaged mixer stage, or insufficient LO to the mixer. You're going to find out that one of those three stages, RF amplifier, mixer, and maybe first IF amplifier, are not going to follow a linear relationship up to something like minus 10, or correction, plus 10 dBm of power output. They better go to something like plus 10 dBm of power output before they go into limiting. And if they're far below that, then it would exactly fit exactly what you're seeing. You're getting what's called noise loading. You've really built yourself by putting the preamplifier in front of its effective stage. You've built what's called a LAMB noise silencer, L-A-M-B, which is a circuit that's intentionally plugged into a radar receiver in order to protect it from broadband barrage jamming. And but it's got these disadvantages of hurting sensitivity on weak signals. And so you've got enough raw data that it seems to fit the issue, and you've got the test equipment to test the theory, and it's an interesting piece of science. Once you complete this test, and if you get a confirmation of what I'm hypothesizing here, Joe, you could write this up as a senior project for a college course.
Yeah, well, I should have qualified when I would have made the statement about the RF detector probe. I realize using the RF detector probe by itself would not have the sensitivity or resolution I'm talking about. I'm talking about using the detector probe on in front of the analyzer as a detection device. That's what I meant to say. I should have qualified what I...
Okay. Almost all detection probes I've ever seen, Joe, take RF input, rectify it, put it through a video bandpass filter, and out comes video. And that's intended to be going into a digital voltmeter, a very sensitive digital millivoltmeter, in order to measure weak signals. That's the exact opposite of what you want in the spectrum analyzer. You want to look at the raw 221 megacycles on the screen of that spectrum analyzer. And that RF probe is doing the best it can to rectify, filter, and get rid of the RF and leave you nothing but DC video. And that's not what you want to see on the spectrum analyzer screen, in my opinion. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, very good. Then I'll have to make myself up some sort of probe that I can couple it into the circuit and get some sort of measurement without affecting the actual performance of the circuit as much as possible. So, okay. I will definitely have to look into doing that. Thanks for the input. This has been very helpful to me. K2RIW, WH4YY.
Yeah, you can do it with a scope probe, Joe. It's not ideal. See, the scope probe, most scope probes are a 10 to 1 ratio, where input impedance is around 10 megohms and 7 picofarads. The output impedance of the scope probe, which goes into the front end of an oscilloscope, normally is loaded down by something like 10 kilo-ohms. You're going to be loading it down by 50 ohms of a network analyzer input impedance. Therefore, the scope probe is going to have a lot of insertion loss. But it's calibratable. And the only slight disadvantage of the scope probe is the 7 picofarad. I think there's a 50-50 chance that a 10-to-1 scope probe, not a 1-to-1 scope probe, although you could use a 1-to-1 scope probe by putting your own series 10K resistor or 1 picofarad capacitor or some combination. But a 10-to-1 scope probe probably will very lightly load the circuit, won't detune it. It'll have 20 dB or so of loss, but you've got more than 20 dB of excess sensitivity of the spectrum analyzer with the preamp. So a scope probe might do what you want. The only thing not so perfect about the scope probe is that it's got a very large end to it, with a lot of extra stray reactants and inductants. An elegant probe, in your case, would be a piece of RG58 cable coming out of the front end of the spectrum analyzer, and make sure that it's capacitively decoupled. The one thing you've got to worry about is if you ever shove a DC voltage of more than 1 volt into the front panel of the spectrum analyzer while the RF attenuator is set at zero, you could blow the front end mixer. It's not a showstopper, but it's an annoyance to go replace that mixer. So by various techniques, you can build, borrow, modify, or whatever, make yourself a very lightly loaded scope probe to do the probing. And you're now to the point where probing is the nicest thing to do. Yeah, you could replace every one of those stages one by one, and that's much too enthusiastic. To do signal tracing is a very sophisticated approach. And you walk along and make sure that each one of those stages has approximately the right amount of gain and approximately the right power output before it goes into 1dB compression. And if you're really wanting enthusiastic, you could even sweep them to make sure they get the right band pass, but that's downrange. You don't have to do that up front. You may get a clue if the spectrum analyzer is sensitive enough, particularly as you work your way downrange and you start developing some gain. The noise that appears across the screen of the spectrum analyzer will have the shape of the filter that you're looking at. If, for instance, you're looking at the first stage of IF gain and the output of that, which has got a filter on it, you should see the bandwidth of noise on the spectrum analyzer screen that is approximately the bandwidth of the filter you're looking at, because the whole system has got very little gain outside of that filter bandwidth, but there's enough gain inside of it that if your sensitivity of your preamp plus spectrum analyzer is high enough, you will see that noise power. Therefore, you'll be looking directly at the shape of the filter of that particular stage. You'll have to be adjusting the spectrum analyzer for 0 dB of attenuation, maximum gain, maximum sensitivity, and you got to be a little bit careful when you do it in that mode. When the front end attenuator of the analyzer is set at 0 dB, you're very vulnerable to putting more than 1 volt in there and blowing that front end stage. Thank you for any further comments, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. The analyzer itself has an input level, maximum input level of, they call it 1 watt, up to plus 30 dBm. I would never even attempt to test this thing like that, because you don't want to know what the repair bill is. The minimum repair bill is to send this thing back to HP. It's phenomenal. Somewhere in the right range of about $4,000 just to look at it. So I'm not going to test that theory.
Yeah, the 1 watt of tolerance is if and only if more than 10 decibels of RF attenuation is dialed into the front panel. Then it can take a watt. When you use all the override controls that are on at your disposal, you may have to go into the book to do it. There is a way that you can force the spectrum analyzer to go down to zero. For reasons of self-protection, it wakes up with 10 dB of attenuation always on the front panel. There's ways you can force that to override down to 0 dB of attenuation. When you're in that override mode, many of the analyzers have got a built-in microprocessor, but when you change any of the controls, it flips back into plugging in a 10 dB attenuator. But by hook or by crook, you can get it down to zero. But when you get it down to zero, you better not hit it with any more than about plus 20 dBm of signal input, or 1 volt of DC. And I'm talking about 1 volt of DC as a spike. In other words, even if you had a coupling capacitor on your probe, and you suddenly go across a 20 volt power supply, because you cannot instantaneously change the voltage on a capacitor, for the first microsecond, 20 volts will appear on the front panel of the analyzer. And it will, on that front panel, when the attenuator is set at zero, will cause failure of the front end mixer when you're in the 0 to 2 gig first range of the spectrum analyzer. Been there, done that, worked for the spectrum analyzer division for lots of years, saw lots of blown out front end mixers from exactly that problem. And the guy said, how can it happen? I was capacitively coupled. I said, yeah, what the hell were you capacitively coupled with? He says, a 001 capacitor. Okay, 001, and what'd you connect it across? Yeah, I connected it across a 35 volt power supply, but the capacitor should have saved it. Uh-uh. You put a 35 volt spike into that front end fella, and that's what blew it. So you see the cautions I'm hitting you with here, Joe, right? KQRIW?
I'm very aware of that, Dick. I really am very aware of using instrumentation properly. You don't get a second chance to blow it up. the first shot, if you're wrong, it's gone, and you're just crying about it. And I can't afford to do that with something like this. It's very expensive to buy, very expensive to get repaired. So I've got to be very, very cautious how I make these kind of measurements so I don't damage anything. I'll probably end up using a I think I do have 10-to-1 skull probes, so I think that should probably work out okay. And I'll let you know how I get how this thing works out once I'm able to get over this guy's house and make a measure of this thing and see if I can actually figure out what stage is actually giving him the business, because it is an interesting problem to try to solve. But I've brought the thing up about the limiting factor of these devices once you that you can bring the intercept point down to such a point where they can actually start acting like a limiter very, very quickly, and that seems to pretty much indicate what's going on here with these things. So very good. All right, back over to you, and you can put it back in rotation there. K2RW TechNet, WA2RYY.
Yes, if this week you're going to get a chance to run these experiments and come back next week and give us a little bit of a report. We're giving you a homework assignment here, Joe.
Oh, gee, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get to this guy's house and make these measurements in 1 week. It might take 2 or 3 weeks to actually do it, but I'll try to definitely get back in here with some technical data on it as to what I found as far as the resolution goes, looking towards a resolution to this whole problem.
You do realize that what you've got there is an extremely rare failure. But I think we've got at least by the time you make all these measurements and gather all this data, as long as you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. In other words, if you see some kind of anomaly, don't think it's just a fluke. Write down everything. And by the time you get through these measurements, it could be a very interesting chunk of physics as to what you discovered on this particular 220 repeater. Okay, Larry, I think it was the next guy who's on our list. Larry, if you're still there, go right ahead, K2RIW, and please repeat your call letters, WB2U-something. Okay, Larry's gone. What's going on in space? Give me your call letters right now.
This is Bob at, W2PNJ.
WPNJ? W2PNJ, go right ahead, Bob.
Dick, I live over in Smithtown. I'm contemplating putting up a tower. I stopped by the building department, and they says that any outside structure past the house, outside from the house, if it's over 15 feet, you need a variance. Do we have anybody in the Limar Club that's expertise in this? Because there's a hearing, you have to bring somebody with does the ARRL have an expert in it, or N2FF, maybe Frank Fallon knows somebody?
Yeah, there's a definite yes to that one, Bob. The Radio Amateur Defense and Information Organization is what it used to be called, RADIO. A group of guys on Long Island, Frank Fallon was one of them, had been to Smithtown. I'll admit that it was about 5, 7, 8 years ago. We defended a man in Smithtown who was putting up a tower in San Remo, and he got his tower. Can't remember the guy's call letters right now. So Smithtown has slowly come around to be a fairly friendly town when it comes to application for a tower and being granted the... You're going to go before the Zoning Board of Appeals, and you're going to be making your pitch. And the main thing they care about is how many feet is there between the tower and the edge of your property, what engineering report is there saying that the tower is strong enough, it's not going to fall over in an 80-mile-an-hour wind. We live in a 75-mile wind area. In other words, once per 50 years, your tower will be hit with a 75-mile-an-hour wind. So as long as there's a safety factor on the wind loading of the tower, confirmed by either an engineering report from the tower manufacturer or from a professional engineer. And so I think your best suggestion is to get a hold of N2FF, who really headed up that committee. He also heads up a committee that's trying very hard to get legislation passed New York State, which means that every ham radio operator doesn't have to go through what you're going through. So yes, you definitely should get your ducks in order before going there, because if it doesn't work well the first time and you say, well, I'm just going to come back later, it's not that easy. You'd really like to do it right the first time. Do you need an attorney? I'm not sure. Most of the successful guys have to be doubled on sure, made sure they're backed up with an attorney representing them before the Zoning Board of Appeals. And so the combination of attorney, the combination of the radio group, the combination of Frank Fallon, and there are specific journals and reports you can get from the ARRL that make favorable suggestions on how to go through this process and make it come out the right way. So I do recommend you get a hold of ARRL and tell them what you're looking for, and they'll say you want package number 45, so to speak. I'm not sure what it's called, but package 45 will tell you almost everything you want to know, particularly if you're already an ARRL member. That combined with a conversation with N2FF, and you'll be well on your way to be prepared for that hearing. And I think there's a 98% chance you're going to get the tower you want, Bob. W2PNJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
That's KT2Q, Tony. He's on Hawthorne Road down at San Remo. Part of the variance system is you got to mail postcards, certified mail, to your neighbors within 200 feet radius of your home. And I'm just wondering what kind of impact if one of them comes up with a negative comment at the hearing.
Yeah, that's very typical Zoning Board of Appeal approach in almost every town on Long Island that I know about, Bob. That is to say, if you're requesting a variance for a zoning factor, just to be informed about when the hearing will take place so that they have the ability to go and listen to the pitch and protest if they feel they must. If you ahead of time know that you have a particular neighbor that you know is particularly negative about your operation, your tower, the television interference they received in the past, or whatever, I would strongly recommend that you do whatever is required to make peace with that neighbor. It's not a showstopper, but it will definitely put you into a tar pit, so to speak, if there is a strongly protesting neighbor. The zoning board will take that into account. If the neighbor sounds thoroughly irrational, if you were able to convince the committee that, yes, the person had television interference, I offered them the filter that would have helped, they denied that the filter would help, they wouldn't allow me to hire a technician to install the filter on their television set, and they still got TVI. I mean, if you get one of these irrational people, then quite possibly the zoning board will ignore it. If, however, there is a rational-sounding neighbor who thinks he's got a significant beef about aesthetics, television interference, radio interference, phonograph interference, hearing aid interference, whatever, and if he thinks he has made complaints to you, and if he thinks those complaints were not properly handled, and that you made no attempt to make amends with him, if you've got a neighbor like that, yes, that can be troublesome. So do your darndest to make sure that none of the neighbors are unhappy, particularly if you've lived there for a significant period of time. That's usually not too difficult. If you're a brand new guy on the block, that's a lot more difficult. You don't know your neighbors yet, so to speak. You're an unknown quantity to them, and because you're a ham radio operator, and it's kind of rare, there's only one of them per 500 in the general population, they may have the mistaken impression that you've got horns coming out of your head, if you know what I mean. Let's hope it's not one of those situations. So these are some of the suggestions that I'm pretty sure that Frank will make to you. Try to have a good relationship with all your neighbors before going to this hearing, because they're going to know the exact date and hour of the hearing, and they will be given an opportunity to stand up and say, I'm against this for these reasons. And if you can cut them off at the pass and make amends with them ahead of time, you're way ahead of the game. Back to you, Bob. W2PNJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine business. Thank you so much, Dick. You hear my kids, they're barking, they're agreeing with you. No, fortunately, I'm in good terms with all my neighbors, so I just want to know what I'm going to get into before I see what's involved, but I'll definitely look Dick up, and I'll give the ARRL a call and see what they can also tell me.
Yeah, the radio committee, the more I think about it, we've defended two towers in Smithtown Township. Three. The one KT2T you're talking about, Tony, in San Remo. There was another one in Fort Salonga. And where was the third one? The one in Fort Salonga, by the way, was a 90-foot tower. And what's amazing about that particular case is he won his case. He put up the tower. The tower was already up. He got it approved. And 6 months later, for reasons I don't understand, he took the tower down and gave up ham radio in the way he was doing it. Unusual case. I'm trying to remember who the third one was, but I think we've had a total of three cases in Smithtown Township. And so Frank probably has better memory than I do, and he was involved in every one of them. We've had them in Riverhead, Smithtown, Huntington, Oyster Bay, Islip, essentially every one of them, Woodbury. Of all of the 13.